We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine from Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Washington Post journalist David Finkel spent 8 months with the Army's 216 in Iraq at the outset of the surge in early 2007. The 216 is short for 2nd Battalion, 16th Infantry Regiment. David Finkel joins us this afternoon to talk about the surge and the soldiers who were part of it. They are stories he tells in his book, The Good Soldiers. Central to the story is the battalion's commander, Army Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Kozlerich. At the time of the 216's deployment, he was 40 years old, a graduate of West Point, and had served 19 years in the Army. Married and the father of 3 young children, his mantra was, "It's all good." When the battalion got to Iraq early in 2007, it was as good as it could have been. David Finkel reports on the early successes of the 216. In his words, other battalions were getting rocked by IEDs, but not them. And Kozlerich kept saying, "It's all good." And that's who they had become as March moved into April. They were the good soldiers. With that passage, however, we sense the battalion soon will have its first casualties. David Finkel is National Enterprise Editor of the Washington Post. And listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or with an email message. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. David Finkel, how are you? Good to talk with you.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So how long had the 216 been in Iraq when they suffered their first fatality?
They landed in Iraq in late February 2007. The first KIA happened in early April. And then they just kept building from there.
Yeah. Who was the first?
A good soldier named Jay Kajimat was out driving a Humvee one evening. And this was the first introduction. Specifically, the soldiers got to a type of roadside bomb called an EFP, which stands for Explosively Formed Penetrator. It's a pretty insidious device, and that turned out to be the weapon of choice in the area of Baghdad they were in. In this case, what happened is the thing exploded and went straight into the very best Humvee the Army had at that point and injured soldiers and basically burned Jay Kajimat to death.
Yeah. Now, you said he was a good soldier. What does it mean to be a good soldier? What would a soldier say is a good soldier? Who is a good soldier?
It's a good question. I think maybe the way to answer it is to describe the battalion briefly. What this book did was it wasn't an attempt to write a policy book. Those had been pretty well done by 2007. This was an on-the-ground, intimately observed book, documentation really, about what happened to one battalion of soldiers that was sent to a central part of the surge. 800 soldiers, average age 19. Most of these, I'll call them kids because I'm older, most of these kids on their first deployment. And I think it's fair to say when they left Kansas to go into Iraq, they were generally optimistic, excited, enthusiastic to be going to a war. Their deployment was 15 months. And by the end, the definition of what a good soldier was had changed to reflect what had happened to them. They had grown up. They had become much more sober and somber and realized what the true effects of war really are.
Yeah. And a good soldier at the end of a deployment, after their first deployment, what?
Well, I think it's someone who came home. If you have 800 soldiers, you're going to have 800 versions of a conclusion of what happened to them. But they had seen it. They had been inside it. They had felt a ceaseless tension of being in Baghdad at that point. They had suffered losses, physical losses, and psychological loss. And so even though they were only 15 months older, you know, of course, like in any war, they were so much older by the time they came home.
Yeah. You mentioned that the average age in the battalion was 19. There was one soldier 17 years old. And there's a scene in the book where a chaplain tells the soldiers gathered for a briefing as they're preparing to be deployed. He says, "This is important. If you are not ready to die, you need to get there." How does a 17-year-old get there?
By going and seeing what happened to Jake Hajmat, or seeing what happened to 13 other soldiers, or the 10% of the battalion that was physically injured, by having to suit up every day and leave this kind of remote base in eastern Baghdad and go into the streets of eastern Baghdad, where these EFPs were waiting everywhere, too many to find, actually. And these things, they were hidden in trash piles. They were hidden in animal carcasses. They were disguised as pieces of curbing, as pieces of wall. And even though there were many, many devices to allow a soldier to overcome them, there were just too many to overcome. And the explosions kept going. And I think more than anything else, the effects of those explosions, the rocket attacks and the mortars attack, came to define what war would be for these 800 young men.
Yeah. How many were killed over the course of the deployment?
14 in this battalion. And again, I guess it was about 10% eligible for Purple Hearts. And these weren't the hand scratch type injuries. These were significant injuries. Now, beyond the 10%, there's an extra number that continue to fight their way through the psychological effects of being in this war for so long.
Mm. How many were seriously injured?
Well, it came down to if 80 or so got Purple Hearts, you know, I would guess that 70 or 75 of those were serious injuries. And when I say serious, missing arms, missing legs, a missing eye, hands, sniper shots to the back of the head, brain surgeries, on and on. And, you know, I should point out that they were in a bad area of Baghdad. There were worse areas. There were battalions that had worse of it than the 216, and there were battalions that had the better of it, I guess is a way to put it. They were somewhere in the middle. To my observations over 8 months, I thought they were remarkable soldiers. That said, you know, they went from a naive optimism at the beginning to, at the end, really questioning what the mission had been about and what they had actually accomplished.
Yeah. Well, the focus of much of this story is the battalion's commander, Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Kozlerich. And maybe you would share with us his feelings about what he hoped to accomplish, what his ideas of success were at the time when he was readying to leave for Iraq, and he was at Fort Riley, Kansas, where they were stationed.
If you and listeners can think back to early 2007, we've reached a point now where violence is down, and to many, many Americans, the war seems pretty much over. That I can argue that's not the case, but that's a perception anyway at this point in 2010. But in early 2007, there was wide acknowledgement that the war seemed to have reached its lost moment. It was pretty much all over. And the surge was just a last-ditch attempt to see if this thing could be straightened out somehow. When George W. Bush announced the surge the night of January 10th, 2007, he acknowledged this in a way where he said, "Many people listening tonight will wonder what the differences will be this time." Then he went on to say, well, here are the differences. And Koslerich, in Fort Riley, Kansas, listening to that speech, knowing he was headed toward it, thought to himself, we're going to be the differences, my battalion, my soldiers, and me. And I think this kind of optimism described Ralph Koslerich then and continues to describe Ralph Koslerich. As far as he's concerned, his soldiers did admirably, and they made a real difference, and the difference is seen to this day. That said, his soldiers, I don't think would many of the soldiers wouldn't necessarily agree with Koslerich on this, because at the end of their deployment, when things had quieted down and they thought they had made a difference, things suddenly became so violent as they were packing up to go home that it left many, many of them quite shaken by what happened at the very end.
And things really got tough in Iraq and for the 216 when they just had a couple of weeks remaining in their deployment late in March of 2008.
Yes, that's right, Celeste. So, they did. And,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I was wondering what the lieutenant colonel's thoughts were at that moment. You know, here's a guy who's a very optimistic fellow, and it's all good.
Well, what some quick background. What had happened is these guys were packing up to go home in March 2008, is that completely separate from them, the prime minister of Iraq made a decision to take some of his troops into southern Iraq, into the city of Basra, which was quite restive, and showed that his troops were ready to bring a place under control. And there were plenty of stories at the time about what happened next. A lot of deserters among the Iraqi forces, many, many civilian casualties. But what was unreported were the effects of that in eastern Baghdad, where the 216 was packing to go home. And the effects were immediate. They shivered their way north into the area of operations where the 216 was. And it went from almost perfect quiet in a moment to absolute flat-out warfare. And instead of packing to go home, these guys were in the fight of their lives in order just to get out of the country. To Koslerich's way of thinking, what happened at that point was a necessary component of a place lurching toward democracy. And he'll make that argument to this day. But to many of the soldiers, it just reflected that to them, they thought they had brought a place under control, and to have it turn so quickly against them made many of them realize they had had little effect at all.
Hmm. Was the surge a success?
Well, I think that's a fair question, and I'm going to give you a kind of a waffling answer, which is I think it's too soon to know. And anybody who can declare that it was a success at this point, it seems premature to me. There's still a war going on. There's factional violence is on the increase again. Commanders in Iraq are on record in today's Washington Post as being concerned about that, what the effects are going to be as American troops continue to draw down and leave the country. We still have 120,000 troops there. So number one, the war isn't done. And number two, it's too soon to say whether the decrease in violence was because of the surge or any of the other things in play at that point. For instance, the Anbar Awakening west of Baghdad. There was the Muqtada al-Sadr ceasefire. There was the fact that when the surge began, so many neighborhoods had been pretty well ethnically cleansed, and so a lot of the violence was down because of that. And you know, I guess some historian someday will tell us it was all these things, but yet to be assigned, I think, are the proportions of each thing.
Wow. Now, parliamentary elections are next month. What's your sense or the sense of Washington Post reporters covering the story of the stability, instability of Iraq today?
Every time the election seems to get close, violence flares up. And I imagine, and you know, I'm not in Iraq at the moment. I'm just a reader like everyone else. But from what I read, the expectation is violence will continue to ramp up, and we'll see what the elections produce, whether it's something the various factions can live with or whether it just leads to more spasms of violence. But I do feel it's a fair thing to say that it's just too soon to say that this is done, that everything has moved on to Afghanistan, because it's we as Americans may be willing to move on from this war, but it's not a done deal yet.
Yeah. It has, it's surprising, though, it has so largely disappeared from the front pages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is there a way to gauge the confidence of the Iraqi people in as far as the upcoming elections and the currently stated U.S. plan for drawdown of troops?
You know, I wish I could give you a definitive answer. I'm hesitant to because I'm not in country and haven't been for some time. And what I'm most aware of is what the Iraqis were feeling, what they were like at that point from 2007 to 2008 while I was there. And in that period, the little I could do to be in touch with – it was a very difficult time to do reporting. I had been in Iraq, not embedded, but as a unilateral reporter at the beginning of the war, which involved finding a four-wheel drive vehicle in Kuwait and crossing the border and just kind of bombing around and seeing what was going on and talking to whomever. By the time I went again to do the book, things had changed so dramatically that to do any kind of independent reporting was awfully dangerous, prohibitively dangerous and very difficult. So if you're an Iraqi at that point, what you're seeing basically is here comes something called the surge. And the intent of the surge was, number one, to protect the population, because if the population feels protected, according to theory, then everything else falls into place. And so here came 30,000 more soldiers in convoys that would roll into a neighborhood, and out would get soldiers, would come soldiers who were just outfitted from head to toe so thoroughly that really no skin was visible. It was helmets. It was eye goggles that were resistant to explosions. It was earplugs, body armor, camouflage, laced-up boots, gloves, knee pads, elbow pads, hundreds of rounds of ammunition, a weapon in hand. And in this way, the Americans would try to engage Iraqis who, simply by being around Americans, you could see getting increasingly nervous because the longer an American stayed talking to them. When the Americans moved on, the next visitor would be some Iraqi saying, why did he talk to the Americans for so long?
Yeah. There's a scene in the book where there's a fellow, an Iraqi man, who invites the soldiers in for tea, and they're very nervous about it. The soldiers are, because they know that he is very likely to face consequences for that.
It was one of the cool days, weather-wise, in Iraq. And by the time – I think the soldiers were in his house for 20 minutes trying to have a conversation. And by the time they left, the man was just so coated in perspiration out of nervousness. And these are how interactions went.
Yeah.
I think it was a time of everyone, almost everyone, trying awfully hard to do the right thing. But it was so difficult to figure out what the right thing was.
Yeah. Well, I get pretty nervous when I'm pulled over for, you know, going through a yellow light. So, I mean, I can't imagine being in that position as a civilian, with all the horror that is around you.
Sure. One of the things I tried to do in the book. Again, it's a book from the soldier's point of view, chronicling what happens to this battalion. I tried as much as possible under the circumstances to bring in Iraqi voices. That said, I think I'm waiting for the great Iraqi book to emerge out of this time. Someone who was in Iraq, an Iraqi who was in Iraq during this time and got everything down, and will publish a book about what it was like to be that person. But there were attempts to bring Iraqi voices into the book. And you know, there were just great heroic characters. There's a young woman who went by the name of Rachel, an Iraqi national who was an interpreter for the military. And Rachel basically was in her mid-20s, slept in a little trailer by herself in a room with an American flag, an Iraqi flag, some stuffed animals, and trying to get herself to sleep every night after being in some 20 explosions. And one day being in the company of a soldier who had been hit by a bomb, and she tried to resuscitate him. And he just kept bleeding so thoroughly, his blood filled up her boots. So she's an important character in the book. And there's a guy who went by the name of Izzy, also an interpreter, who loved America so much that among the few possessions he carried with him wherever he went was a frequent flyer card from Pan American World Airways, which, of course, had been out of business for a long time at that point.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's just through characters, through the characters in this book, I think there's a way to get a sense of how the surge felt on the ground, not at the high levels of policy in Washington, but what it was like to be a soldier, especially during that critical time in Iraq.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Washington Post journalist David Finkel. He spent 8 months with the Army's 216 in Iraq at the outset of the surge in early 2007. He tells their stories in his book, The Good Soldiers. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call or an email message, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Is the surge a model for operations in Afghanistan? I don't want to get too much into policy here, but I do want to I would like to have your thoughts on a couple of questions in that regard here today.
From what I've read and the people I've talked to, generally, yes. Specifically, not so much. They're just two entirely different countries. Iraq is so much more urban. And Afghanistan, which I spent time in just before 9/11, well, we know what Afghanistan is. It's a failed state. It's almost a feudal state in so many ways. So if the basic concept is to protect the population, the populations are so different that the concept of protection differs from place to place. So there may be some measures that translate and transfer pretty cleanly from one country to another. But from what I gather, the day-to-day operations are just so different.
Mm. And thinking of Afghanistan and Iraq simultaneously here, I wonder, where is the 216 today?
Oh, that's a good question. They came back in April 2008. They had a little downtime to recover. Probably a third of the battalion remained in the 216, and they're back in Iraq at the moment. Others have moved on to other battalions, some of which are in Afghanistan. A few soldiers have come back with fresh injuries that they received in Afghanistan. And, you know, a lot of the guys simply got out of the Army. They for whatever reason, they got out. And they, from private places, they are continuing to fight this war in their own minds, sometimes with pretty sad, dramatic results.
Yeah, and I mentioned in my introduction earlier that Kozlerich is married and the father of three young children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just soldiers, it's families.
It's families as well.
And communities.
You know, well, getting a chance to see some of the families close up during the reporting of this book was so instructive and so moving. And the book in some ways is an attempt to talk about how any war is really two wars. There's the war as it's being fought in Washington through policy, through politics and money. And then there's the war on the far end, which was the one being fought by the 216. And if I can tell – do you mind if I just give a quick example of how different the two wars can be?
Sure.
There was a guy named Michael Emery, who was on a rooftop in April 2007 when a sniper got him, a clean shot to the back of the head. And down went Emery on the rooftop. Didn't die. He was airlifted to Landstuhl, Germany, and then later to Bethesda Naval here in Maryland in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. And every day, Kozlerich would get some kind of update from the States about how Emery was progressing. He's doing good. He's sitting up. He told his wife, "I love you." And this was all very good news to the battalion. But at some point, a few weeks after Emery was shot, I left Baghdad, came back to the States, went to visit Emory at Bethesda Naval. He was being taken care of by his wife, Maria. And the truth of what it means to sit up and talk became so apparent. He was diapered. He was whimpering. He couldn't speak. He could barely move. He was being taken care of a wife who in a few weeks had lost her dress size, had gone from a size 12 to a size 6. And she was angry because of a policy she didn't understand. And her family was ruined. And she told me about a day that President Bush came to visit Bethesda Naval and came to talk to her and the family. And just to read a quick part from the book, Bush came over and told her that, as she put it, he was sorry for what our family was going through. And she had said to him, thank you for coming. And she wished she had said more to him because he didn't understand as far as she was concerned. And he doesn't know how it feels. And she didn't agree with what was going on with the war. But she didn't want to say anything to Bush because it would have upset her husband. So she began to cry. And Bush, misreading her tears, came over and hugged her and basically had no idea that the tears were because of anger and specifically because of Bush himself. And then she went on from there talking about what life had become because of living the far effects of a policy decision.
Hmm. You know, it seems to me that in these two wars, we have seen soldiers speaking their minds about what their opinion of of the conflicts are, and that strikes me as being new. People who are actively serving.
Maybe soldiers always spoke their minds, but now there are more avenues for them, more public avenues for them to do it. There was limited internet access over there, so soldiers could be much more in touch with people back home than ever before. Some soldiers would post things to blogs, and if not through social networking, would somehow be more in touch with families back home, and that might be a little bit of what you're talking about.
Mm. Is Kozlerich still in?
He is. He's back in Iraq at
the
moment. He left in January, and he's there for another year. And as I said, most of the guys are over there, either in Iraq or Afghanistan. Except for the few who have gotten out and trying to move on with their lives. There's a, you know, there was a guy in the book, I was talking about Michael Emory being shot on the rooftop. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to get him down the stairs for medical help. And finally, there was a soldier named Adam Schumann who picked up Emory. And Emory's a big guy, but Schumann just finally picked him up and threw him across his back and moved him down three flights of stairs. And it just so happened because of the angle of things, much of the blood coming out of Michael Emory's head went straight into Adam Schumann's mouth. And 6 months later, Adam Schumann was still tasting that blood. And the time came that he simply couldn't be a soldier anymore. And by general acknowledgement, he was one of the very best soldiers in this battalion. But he was turning increasingly suicidal in thinking and couldn't sleep and simply had to get out with a severe case of PTSD. So Adam Schumann is home now. He's back in Kansas. He is fighting as hard as anyone I've ever met to make himself better. But, you know, it's a couple of years later, it continues to be quite difficult for him. And we're not talking about a malingerer or a bad guy in any way. He really was one of the very best in this battalion. And so he's an example of the effects of this war that are beginning to seep into American communities. I'm sure they're in Champaign-Urbana. They're in Kansas. They're in this area. The war, it's an interesting moment as Iraq fades from consciousness, but now it's beginning to move into America more thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking now of Kozlerich and his family, his wife Stephanie, also West Point, three children, and now they're all 3 years older than when we're introduced to them at the outset of The Good Soldiers. What can you tell us a little bit about Stephanie and about her life as a soldier, as a mother, as a wife of a soldier?
Well, I can tell you a little bit. Stephanie was and remains. I like Stephanie very, very much. Three great kids, young kids. It was more difficult the first time when her husband left because it was a long deployment into a very violent place. And when he left this time, I happened to go spend the evening with the Koslerichs the night before Ralph deployed again. And it was a different scene. This is a family that in some ways had adapted to the idea that one member is going to be gone to a bad place for a little while. Maybe it's because of the experiences of the first time. Maybe it's because Kossler survived. Maybe it's the force of his personality. But it was a bit more perfunctory and easier to bear in a way than the first time I watched them get ready to separate as a family.
Yeah. At the close of the book, even though Koslerich is overall a very – he's a strong character. He's a strong man, good soldier, good leader. But at the close of the story, you have him thinking or saying, I've seen enough. Mm-hmm. Is that how it goes? I'm pulling this out of my memory.
No, that is how it goes, and that's certainly how it was for him. And this is the most ceaselessly optimistic person in the battalion. It's just there's a point where you know enough is enough, and they had a rough go of it. Again, as far as I can tell, there were not very many bad soldiers in this group I followed. They were pretty admirable, but. It was hard, and it was hard for me. I had luxuries the soldiers didn't have. I could take breaks now and then. I could either get off the base and go to the Washington Post Baghdad Bureau for a few days and just sort of take a breath. I could come back to the States and do some reporting here, take a break before I went back over there to do more reporting in Baghdad. But these guys, they didn't have that luxury except for 18 days at home. For 14 months on the ground out of their – it was a 15-month deployment, but they were on the ground for 14 months. And every day they were there, they faced the very strong possibility that something was waiting to get them. And from what I've read about other wars, their predictable patterns emerge that, you know, war is never a good thing or an easy thing, but at least soldiers, troops are able to – fairly predict what might be in wait for them. And that wasn't the case here. Once on the base, which was – it was bad enough because it was constantly being rocketed and mortared. But once you went out of the wire, off the base, the bombs were waiting for you everywhere. And they really were. I'm not exaggerating. And so if you're a soldier and you have no choice but to go out every day in this – of course it leaves you exhausted at the end, and you need to come home and have that break and try to get it together.
Hmm. Why do you want to go back?
Well, it was interesting to see how many of the guys re-upped while they were over there. There were many, many re-enlistment ceremonies, and it seems a lot of the reason – you know, first of all, we're dealing with I think the military reflects certain segments of the American population, tends to be more patriotic. There's also a bit more economic need, I think it's safe to say, in the people who choose to go in the military at the moment. And I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think that's a safe thing to say. So the guys were given a choice over there. You can re-enlist, and if you do it, by the way, if you do it while you're here, you can earn a bonus of up to $30,000. Oh, and if you do it here rather than wait to get back to the States, it's tax-free money. And so if you're a kid from a depressed area of Ohio or Illinois or anywhere really, and you don't exactly have a lot of job prospects waiting for you back in the States, and somebody's offering $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in front of you tax-free, that's a pretty good incentive to re-enlist. Mm. So I would go to these ceremonies and watch these kids re-up again. And the thing about being there, I have to tell you, Celeste, everything, I guess, gets exaggerated into such emotional extremes just because of the intensity of the place. And so many things, they were almost the small acts of decency that would do this to me, but so many things would just produce emotional reaction of just shivers and tears. And these reenlistment ceremonies, for a variety of reasons, good and bad, just got to me every time.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is journalist David Finkel. He's the author of The Good Soldiers. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The Washington Post. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join our discussion with a telephone call or an email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Do you think in the mind of the public we're getting better at, thanks to your efforts and the efforts of other reporters and soldiers themselves, that we today we have a better idea of who they are and what they're doing and what they've been asked to do?
I'd like to think that, but my sense is that many, if most, if not most people, don't really pay much attention to these wars. They may, we may, I'll include myself in this before I went, pick up the paper, see a headline that says three soldiers killed in East Baghdad by a roadside bomb, and maybe pause for a minute and think, well, that's kind of sad. And that's the level of engagement. And then it's, you know, on to the next story in the paper. And I guess that's the way it goes. But after being there and seeing what three dead in East Baghdad actually means, that it means three soldiers are dead in a road, and a fourth has just lost both of his legs, and the fifth lost both of his legs, his right arm completely, and most of his left arm, and is burned over the rest of his body, and now faces the next 4 months of having his ears fall off and his nose fall off and his eyebrows be gone and 30 surgeries and burn treatments. And then finally, after 4 months of fighting, then die. It's become more personal. And I don't know if people are paying more attention. I would like them to. And I would like people to more fully understand that when a decision is made to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, that may be a legitimate decision, but we've just created the 30,000 new possibilities of having a 19-year-old kid like Duncan Crookston, who was the one who hung on for 4 months before he finally died.
Hmm. Let's take a call. We have a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you. Seems to me that you've done a good job of not glamorizing a fair appraisal of what you saw, which isn't always the case, unfortunately. It seems to me we paid a terrible price.
Celeste, I'm afraid I couldn't hear what the caller said.
Oh, okay.
May I repeat?
Yeah.
Now I can hear you.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
I'm so sorry about that.
I'd like to thank you for doing what seems to me a fair job. That is, not quantitatively, but that you have not glamorized or glorified what was being done in Iraq. That it seems an accurate appraisal.
Well, I appreciate that, and you know, two responses come to mind. The first is when I set out to do this book, I did make a promise to Ralph Koslerich that I was coming over without any agenda at all. That I had no interest in what I thought of the war. My interest is, was simply in watching what happened to him and his battalion. And Kosserich, to his credit, said, look, if that's your promise, I'll make your promise too. Come on over. You have full access to everything going on. And write your book. And I tried my best to keep my promise. I think it would, anybody would be hard-pressed to read this book and know what I might think about the war, because that's not the point. The point is really to document what happens to young men, to use the war really to write about the character of young men who are put in a situation like this. I was just going to say, the other comment is that after the book came out, I think it took quite a while to gain the trust of the soldiers who wondered, for obvious reasons, who is this guy in their midst? Why was he writing everything down? What was he up to? What was the real agenda? Since the book came out, I've gotten so many emails from soldiers, not just in this battalion, but a lot of battalions, saying basically, you know, I read your book. And I wanted to write to you because I came home from the war and everyone wanted to know what was it like, and I couldn't talk about it and I can't talk about it and I don't want to talk about it. But now I can give people your book and say, read this and you'll know what happened and why I can't talk about it. So that's another way of just saying thanks for your comment.
It seems to me that we are going to pay a horrible price for this misadventure. In your case, this battalion saw 10% casualties of a serious nature, missing arms, missing legs, eyes. But the statistics I'm seeing are that probably a third of these people will also suffer serious and lasting psychological damage.
Well, that is a concern.
And that's going to go on for decades in all likelihood.
One thing early in your comment, when you've used the phrase misadventure, I don't necessarily want to go along with that characterization. But that aside, you're exactly right. All the internal studies and external studies are showing an astonishing rate of psychological damage from this war. And maybe that's just the way it goes in any war. Nonetheless, it's happening in this war, and as I said earlier, we're now seeing the effects of it seeping into more and more American communities, and it'll be with us for quite some time. To put myself in a soldier's head for a moment, to have spent so much time in such a place doing the things they had to do. Making these absurd, heartbreaking daily calculations, for instance, of today when I get in the Humvee, I'm going to sit with one foot in front of the other so that when the bomb comes in, I'll lose one foot instead of two. It made perfect sense at the time. But when you get home, there are cumulative effects that all of these soldiers, even the ones who came through it fine, are simply going to be contending with for a long time. I would assume the rest of their lives.
My reason for calling it a misadventure is, quite simply, that I think the results are not going to be to our advantage. We are accumulating a tremendous legacy of hatred on the part of people of the Middle East. I know that it's dangerous to generalize from a single instance. But it appears that this young Nigerian man who attempted to blow up an airliner on Christmas Day was very much motivated by what he had seen taking place in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I don't think this is isolated. And I think it is something that is going to carry on for a very long time. These people hate the British with good reason. I think they may now hate us with equally good reason and for a very, very long time.
I want to thank the listener for his call. And go ahead, and we're running down on time. So,
sure. I was just going to say one thing about, the phrase misadventure. I would guess there are some soldiers I was with who to this day would use that word to characterize what they went through. And there are plenty who would characterize it in other ways, successful, somewhat successful. You know, it's just in this case, just to talk about the soldiers themselves, it really comes down to who the man was when he left and who the man had become by the time he came home.
Mm-hmm. There we'll leave it. David, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, Celeste, thank you very much.
David Finkel has been our guest this afternoon. He's a journalist with The Washington Post. He's National Enterprise Editor for The Washington Post. He was awarded the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his series of stories about U.S.-funded democracy efforts in Yemen. He is the author of the new book, The Good Soldiers, and the book is a Sarah Crichton book published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.